This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Andy Diamond. He is with the band Diamond Field. Andy, great talking to you.
Hey, Robert. How you doing?
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, Andy.
Hey, Pilliter. How you doing?
Great.
Yeah.
With the label Diamond Field, I know you've done a lot of different collaborations. Is this a solo act, primarily?
Yeah, I mean, I think with a lot of this style of music, it tends to be one person making everything. But I like to be a little bit more collaborative. And what happens with Diamond Field is I write and produce all the music, and then I get different vocalists to come in and sing on each track. So it's predominantly a vocal-based outfit. It's not an instrumental-focused thing like a lot of other synthwave acts might be. But I like to work with other vocalists and other musicians, so if I need a certain instrument played, I might get someone else to come in and play on it. So it opens things up a little more and also makes things quite difficult because you're dealing with a whole lot of different people. So.
And your music, would you say you'd identify primarily with the new retrowave genre?
Yeah, I always have a little bit of an issue with calling it new retrowave because that's essentially the name of a channel and a label. Mm. And so I often say, well, yeah, that's often how people find that genre. I guess for me, the broader synthwave term is better because it kind of incorporates instrumental music and outrun and vocal synth pop and all those kinds of things. Anything that kind of has an 80s vibe or influence to it.
That's interesting because for a long time, the music I would make, though you would call it digital hardcore, that's a record label by Atari Teenage Riot, and it's their label, even though it's right. A unique brand of music. So other names thrown out there, are breakcore or some extreme form of power noise. But that's very interesting that people get attached to genres. But it turns out the genre is a brand name. You can't really go around it. But it makes me think about what is concrete. I mean, certainly house music is so concrete today. It's a household name, pun intended.
Sure. Sure. And I think you often have different types of music that might have started taking, like they might have taken a name from an album title or a book or something. And those artists become known with that particular name, and then that genre kind of gets also tagged with that name. So it's almost like who's first on the block, and then it gets picked up and run with. And then once that is established, when you have newer people coming in later on, they tend to go for the biggest sort of thing that's most obvious and kind of pick up on that. And I think that's kind of what happened with new retro wave, is they're so huge that people kind of think it's a style of music, whereas actually it's actually an outlet for that style of music.
How long have you been making music, and what genres were you interested in before you discovered the new retrowave and synthwave genre?
That's an interesting question. I was actually making this kind of music in the 80s. So I'm a little older. Some of my contemporaries are in their early 20s, and some of them are my age, which is a little older. So we were in the 80s the first time around. So you could say I've not actually stopped making this music since then. It just so happens that now there's an outlet for the stuff that I was always making that went out of fashion for a while, and suddenly I found a whole lot of other people were reviving it, and I thought, oh, that's kind of convenient. There's actually a market there now. But aside from that, I play in conventional bands and have played with rock bands and indie bands and pop bands and singer-songwriters and any type of music across the board. So the sort of synthwave thing or the 80s stuff is kind of a personal favorite that I like to do.
That's interesting you brought up that you were performing music in the 80s. Yep. Would you say with new retrowave, it's not so much based, for most of the people, you would say it's not so much based on the nostalgia, it's based more on younger people who don't really remember the 80s. A lot of people who were, say, born in the early 90s. I mean, sure. I was born in 85, so I'm kind of somewhere in between. But it's kind of interesting. It's not really nostalgia, because I know a lot of people in their 40s and 50s, they're just going to want to listen to the music that they're nostalgic for growing up, and they're maybe less aware of new retrowave.
Yeah, possibly. Although I know quite a few artists who are in the synthwave scene are second time rounders, if you like. Who are a little older, some who were born in the 70s, some who were born in the late 70s or the very, very early 80s. I can understand with you, if you were born in 85, you would have been 5 years old in 1990, so the 80s would have passed you by. And, you know, I think there's one thing for nostalgia if you've been through it, and there's another kind of nostalgia for things that you never lived through at all. And I think you see that in all sorts of fads and culture sort of culture things, and if you look at it, I think that the most telling thing about whether a musical genre or a pop culture thing is becoming—I don't want to say the word legitimate as such, but something like that—is when young people who never lived through it pick up on it and they find something in it that appeals to them, so they want to recreate that. It's not because they lived through it. It's because they find something in it that they like. And I think that's the real test. You know, it's not just a bunch of old geezers trying to relive their youth. You know, it's you know, the majority is young people picking up on things that they like about the culture that they didn't live through, but they like aspects of it.
I can agree, because right now to make music, I have Reason 9.5, and recently Reason now accepts VSTs, which is a very important part that for a long time Reason has not accepted VSTs. And for about 3 weeks, one of my traditions in the past 2 weeks or two years has been I've been retrying to make authentic Chicago house music, so I'd only pay attention to sample bass. TR 505, 606, 707, 808, and 909. And it's very strange, is because I'll even get an obscure VST like Rave Generator and get that one noise from that one track. I think the commercial version of This Is Acid, it's called the Black Riot preset. And then you have this like old school kind of rave music made in 2017, but it sounds like it's from 88 or something. And I've been trying to do that to a perfection, and I can totally relate to that.
I mean, but you know, when you do that music, are you frustrated that it may not sound exactly like the original?
Yeah, there's definitely a digital thing, but I think programs are becoming so advanced that, you know, there's filters and kind of mastering techniques where you can make it sound old and you make it sound authentic. And I'm learning that, and I find them because I worked with hardware. It's just the problem is hardware is just expensive today. I mean, it's ridiculous. Even if you were to you know, get a $400 drum machine or synthesizer compared to a $100 VST or something like that, and I just find that music production on the computer today, especially with the whole vaporwave revolution, all you need to do is go on YouTube. Get an embarrassing 80s song, get clip converter, get the file, extract it, put it in Audacity, slow it down, and put some reverb on it, and you have a vaporwave track.
Exactly. I mean, there's a kind of thing that I found frustrating, because I had a whole lot of hardware, and I kept it until I had to relocate countries, so I couldn't keep it all. It was just kind of pointless, and I went from having a whole lot of hardware to purely software studio. But even with the hardware, you know, I'd spend half an hour turning everything on before I even started working on a track, you know. So the, you know, the software thing is very convenient. But on the other hand, you know, you have all these tracks available to you, and then you put all these things down, and you put another track on, and you go, well, this doesn't sound like Yazoo, or it doesn't sound like Depeche Mode or anything. It's because they only had 8 or 16 tracks to work with, and they weren't dicking around with endless kind of, you know, they had to make a decision. And I think that sometimes that's lost on any type of music production now because people have so many choices, so you've got to be very disciplined.
Did you have any particular bands that were your favorite growing up?
Oh, yeah, tons. I think primarily ABBA were one, mainly because I grew up with them as a young kid, and my dad would play ABBA, and I just really liked their song arrangements and their production, and as I got older, I kind of appreciated the technicality of what they did. But growing up, it was more things like Simple Minds and Ultravox, Duran Duran, Berlin, you know, all those kind of new wave synth pop type things.
Was that big in New Zealand?
Yes, it was actually. And there was a lot of bands that are actually quite well known that only had number one hits or top 10 hits in New Zealand of all places, outside of Europe or the US. You know, they might have been number 22 in the US, but they were number one in New Zealand and Australia. They were quite popular. It's quite weird. Unfortunately, the size of the countries meant that if you had a gold record in New Zealand, you know, you might have made $5. Whereas if you had a gold record in the US, you'd make $1 million. It's just the scale of population. So I think when you're an isolated country like New Zealand, especially in that time, you got to hear music from Europe, the US and the UK and Australia. It was a filter. So you weren't always just listening to American music or just English music. You had a whole lot of things coming in, so we were able to kind of skim the cream of the crop.
So your latest album is called Closer, and this is a collaboration with Rat Rios on vocals.
Yeah, that's Closer is actually the third official Diamond Field single. And so when I make singles, I do these maxi singles, which is also a kind of a throwback to the 80s, where you'd get a maxi single which had, you know, an instrumental version or a remix or an extended mix, and more than a remix, because remixes in the 80s were less of a thing. It was more about a extended mix or a dance remix, which was essentially just taking the same track elements and just extending pieces out. It wasn't like giving it to another artist and they would do another remix of it as such. I mean, there were DJs and stuff who made specific dance versions of songs. There's the Disco Net label, which was quite popular. But it was all pretty much taking a razor blade to the original. So with this maxi single thing, I always do a 12-inch extended mix in the style of the 80s, which pulls different elements out of the original track. So it still sounds like the same track. It's just, you know, longer. And then I get other artists to remix it. And so with Closer, it's the same format again. And this time we have two artists from a label called Prince George Records, which are in Washington, D.C., called Furniture and Saint Samuel, who are two acts that I really like, and they did remixes, and another act from South Carolina called Stereo Spread, and a synthwave artist from France called Morgan Willis. You know, he's kind of he's much more in that sort of new retro wave vein, where the other acts are kind of more alternative indie electronic pop. So I tried to give it a good broad brush of remixes.
You did a music video called Neon Summer, and this was a collaboration with Nina Yasmine, and this was filmed at the Santa Monica Pier in LA.
That's right. And Neon Summer was the first official Diamond Field track, 2013, I think that came, 2014. It's getting on a bit. And so Nina was one of those classic stories, you know, when you meet people on the internet, and I met Nina on the internet, and I was looking for a vocalist, and I heard her voice on a song, and I said, "Do you want to do this?" She said, "Yep," and she sent me the files, and that was it. And then I ended up playing with her and for her original music and so forth, because she was in Brooklyn as well. She's moved to LA now. But anyway, that video was shot by a friend of mine who's a New Zealand director. He lives in Santa Monica, and he was testing out a camera, and I said, "Have you got any shots of LA and stuff that you could give me?" And he said, "I can do better than that. I'll go and shoot you the stuff. I've got these models and you can have the footage. And so he gave me that, and it came out beautifully, and I just edited it up and put it into a video. So the people in that video are not me or Nina. They're kind of like whoever you want them to be.
And I actually grew up in that area.
Yeah.
Have you been there? Or you,
Yes, I have, and I very much like L.A. and have some good friends who live in that part of Santa Monica. And so to me, I mean, I'm in the East Coast, you know, so we have beaches and stuff like that over here, but there's something about the Santa Monica Pier in L.A. and Venice Beach and that I really like. And we wanted to kind of capture that carefree sort of feeling that the song evokes, that whole, that sort of John Hughes movie type montage feeling, where there's a couple just running along the beach and having a great time, and there's this kind of 80s sort of sounding music in the background. So it kind of conveys a sense of innocence and also just kind of that raw teenage kind of hope that everything can be really cool if you've got the right music and the right person, you know?
And you also have the animated neon for the opening for the cover of that.
The Twin Peaks one?
The Twin Peaks and for the Neon Summer.
Yeah, the Neon Summer thing. This is really interesting because when, you know, you mentioned new retro wave and how people perceive the scene and stuff, and back then, the particular scene, it was all about neon and, you know, DeLoreans and palm trees and flamingos and, you know, neon signs and all that kind of stuff, which is very cool. And I kind of wanted to play on that a little bit, but I've kind of moved away a little bit from that stuff. But it was fun to do the neon sign animation thing for that. So that was to excuse the pun, but it was kind of a sign of that particular time that I was on that sort of bent, if you know what I mean, with the whole retro neon thing.
Yeah, I kind of associate animated neon, especially with the 50s. I was talking to this blogger from New York, Thomas Rinaldi. His blog is called New York Neon.
And yes, I saw told that.
Him,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I told him about the new retrowave thing, and he's like a big expert on this. He said it was kind of ironic, is really the peak of that signage was like the 30s to the 60s. But mm-hmm. he said basically in the 80s, there was a pretty strong decline. Mm-hmm. And but it goes back to show you that new retrowave doesn't have to be this exact replica of the 80s. It's sort of people coming up with their own unique aesthetic image.
That's right, and I try to do that. And also, I first coined a phrase that I thought was quite good for what I was trying to do, which I probably should trademark. Someone told me you should trademark that. It's 21st century 80s music is what I call the stuff that I do. And I think it can apply to a whole lot of synthwave because it is. It's 80s style music made in the 21st century. And I'd like to think that, you know, that you're talking about the neon thing where the authenticity of that was really in, you know, I guess it peaked in the 1950s.
And Twin Peaks came out in 1990.
That's right.
But there's a lot of 50s nostalgia in that.
That's right. And I think, again, it's like we were talking about before, where people pick up on certain aspects of things. So if you didn't grow up in the 80s and you see a whole lot of neon signs that are pertaining to 80s things, you must kind of think, oh, the 80s had a whole lot of neon, which to some extent it did, but it was in specific places like nightclubs and, you know, certain places that had a concentration of it, but it was, like you say, in decline because it was expensive and it was, you know, there were cheaper ways of doing signage, basically.
I have a question. Speaking of singles and remixing, what do you think about DJ culture today? Because I find that years ago, it was only 20 years ago that people were, or even 30, that you had vinyl records, then moved on to CDs. All of a sudden, when the MP3 format or digital became, everybody could just, you know, now today you can just pretty much play it from your iPad and have a Bluetooth speaker or whatever device, and just there are many programs online, especially that there's DJ assistant programs like Beatport, you know, that you could just mix and match tracks together, and just all you have to do is fade the switcher and press some effects. And it seems now today that DJing is very easy to do. However, I find that, you know, the single is dead, that there is no extended dance mix or a 12-inch mix where, you know, they begin with the 4-on-4 beat and 4-on-4 exit. It seems that the DJ mixing is very much very fast. I'm saying is that we're seeing less these remix albums or remixes because people just want to hear the original cut. You know, there once were single or radio mixes, but we hardly see that anymore.
Yeah, and I don't know, it's kind of maybe people have a short attention span, so they want to rattle through 10 tracks in 2 minutes, you know. I guess that some styles of music demand that these days. I mean, for me personally, putting the different remixes on a single is for two reasons. First, it means you're not just getting one song, so you get value for money, you get a bit more value for your buck, if you know what I mean. There's some more options, and also some people might not like the original version, but they might like the remix version of it, or the remix. They might hear the remix first, and that's the way into the other music that you put out. And also, I think it just gives it a bit more integrity than just putting a single on SoundCloud or Bandcamp and just kind of forgetting about it. But with the whole DJ culture, I know what you mean, and it you'll see endless debates on Facebook forums or groups or whatever saying DJs have no skill. All they do is press a button and anybody could do that. And, you know, you need to be a real musician. And that also goes back to electronic musicians who have a laptop and, you know, some MIDI controller where they're just pressing some loop and people go poo-poo at that. But I think you've got to put it into context. If you're a good DJ and you know how to select the tracks, and that's where that word selector comes from, then that puts you up another step from anyone who can just press a button and play music, because it's about being a good chooser of the tracks that are going to get people dancing or create a mood or whatever. And I guess if you're a musician and you make music, you need someone who's really good to play your music to other people, whether it's a DJ on the radio or a DJ at a dance party or a bar or whatever. So, and, you know, you said you're into house music and stuff like that. You'll know about all the great house music DJs that are still going. Some of them have passed away recently, which is sad. Oh, yeah. But,
I was thinking when you're saying DJs, I was thinking of Goldie, because I think of how much of a celebrity he is. And sometimes it's his personality that really, as the selector rather than musician, it becomes an art form in itself.
Exactly. But yeah, there's a whole lot of people you could start rattling off who are, you know, Norman Jay, or, you know, or you could go for Carl Craig, or you could, you know, and I guess people think of DJs now, they is someone like Skrillex a DJ, or, you know, is it, was
really funny. I think I am very critical of Deadmau5 and Skrillex. I mean, they're up and coming American DJs, but I find that it's this rock star lifestyle at the same time. But I think they are musicians in some respect, and I do think they have talent, but they're also their selectors, you could say, as well.
That's true, and they have a certain audience who like that sort of music. And I think inevitably what's going to happen, and it probably has started happening, or it's always still going, is people will come back or rediscover the music that you were talking about before, the 80s techno stuff, the Detroit sound, you know, Chicago house, New York stuff. You know, they'll come back to it because they'll just say, hey, I've had enough of this you know, EDM stuff. I just want to
some of my favorite DJs are Todd Edwards and Joey Beltram. They're still going at it, and they're very cool to see live. You know, they're the traditional DJs, and they know how to, they play older tracks. But it's interesting though about Skrillex and Deadmau5, because I always think they come from the tradition of Limp Bizkit or some kind of metalcore act, like they're rock and roll stars. That's an interesting contrast if you compare different DJs, and it's almost a different subculture of the DJ thing as they're reinventing it in this rock star lifestyle and making it accessible, I guess, to rockers, even though how cliche that sounds.
No, you're right, because, and that's actually something that's very, very pertinent to the synthwave scene, is that you'll find a lot of the artists that are now coming into it are all people who used to make dark metal or death metal, or, you know, not quite death metal, but really hardcore metal stuff, and they've discovered through apps like Perturbator and, you know, Carpenter Brute and all these people that quite make this heavy kind of synth stuff, but it's got that heavy metal, hardcore rock, dark kind of thing going on, and they instantly can just almost transition into this new thing. So you've got this whole dark wave, heavy kind of synth. Someone nicknamed it Satan Wave recently, because
a witch house. I mean, these names that come up. I'm not a fan of witch house, but everybody has a new genre, and it seems so much. Yeah. Back in the when I was little, like I said before, I thought digital hardcore was whoa, what is this? And now it's like today, you have everything from C-punk to witch house, and people take it as a lifestyle choice. Huh. We're bombarded with genres.
Exactly right, but I think it's really interesting. Like you were talking about that whole rock thing, it's pretty much like now you don't have to put the guitars on anymore. Well, you can still put your guitars on with synth music, but you can actually create, like, you know, they're wearing kind of masks and things, and it's kind of like you said, it's like the Limp Bizkit. It's kind of like Slipknot have moved. They've thrown away their guitars and taken up synthesizers and making this really heavy music, and it's almost like a instant audience they have, because the people are moving over from, it's a natural progression from the sort of hardcore, and I don't mean hardcore like Black Flag and Bad Brains and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's quite interesting. So, and this is another thing where people kind of think synthwave is instrument hard heavy instrumental stuff like Perturbator and stuff, and it's quite a lot broader than that.
This might sound weird, but I remember growing up when I was 16, the word hardcore I knew was like the Swedish gabber music. And then I was 18, somebody told me, no, there's such a thing called hardcore punk. I'm like, what?
Yep.
And then I was like, this is weird. And the only thing
happy
I said,
hardcore.
Yeah, happy hard. I love that too. Happy hardcore. I try to make that. But I think the only accessible I could understand was digital hardcore, where I felt, okay, I understand that there's gabber and the mix between the punk, you know, and I guess the word hardcore or even hard can be used anything you want it to be, just so long as it's relative.
With the Twin Peaks series you did, that was for Retro Promenade. You did the animation illustrations. And there's also some merchandise, including T-shirts, and you did two different songs for that. You did the Song of the Nightingale and Diamond Field and the Black Lodge Girls. Mm-hmm. Was this just a purely coincidental, or was there some anticipation for a new Twin Peaks?
I'm pretty sure that when Mike Huha, who runs Retro Promenade, had the idea to do the Twin Peaks tribute series. And originally, I think it was just one album, but they had so much interest in it, he decided to expand it over three volumes. But Retro Promenade, as well as releasing original artists, also had quite a big thing for doing tribute compilations. They did a Miami Vice one and, you know, some film soundtrack ones. So I guess I think Twin Peaks, the new series, had kind of been announced that it was going to go ahead, and this was before Lynch kind of pulled out and said, "Nah, I'm not going to do it," you know, because it was originally going to be 8 episodes or whatever, and then he came back in later on. So there was an anticipation of that, and it's one of those things that everybody was clamoring to be on it, including myself, because I'd been on a few compilations and things, but I was really trying to concentrate on my own original stuff, but I couldn't pass up the chance to be on a Twin Peaks tribute, because that's something that I'm really into, and I you know, so we could talk all night about Twin Peaks.
Can you talk about the songs you did? The Nightingale is based on the Nightingale is the bird that hears Laura, and that's revealed in the prequel Fire Walk With Me, but there's also in the original series Agent Cooper discovers the bird, and then the bird is mysteriously killed after the bird reveals the secrets. And then the other one you did was Diamond Field and the Black Lodge Girls, and that has an animation of the Black Lodge.
That's really a spoiler right there. I mean, especially in the introduction of Twin Peaks, we see the bird, so...
Yeah, that's right, that's right. And, I mean, as I said, I'm a fan of Twin Peaks. I remember, obviously, I was living in New Zealand, and a friend sent me a letter from America, and in those days, that's how you communicated. You sent everybody letters, and they said, oh, you have to watch this great, a fantastic show called Twin Peaks that's coming out. And, of course, we got everything 6 months later, a year later almost. And I thought, Twin Peaks, that's kind of a dumb name, a stupid name for something. Sounds a bit naff. And
yeah, when I originally – I mean, I'm a big fan now, but my original impression was that I thought it was going to be like some cheesy soap opera.
The same.
But then when I actually discovered it, it was one of the best shows I've ever seen.
Yeah, so it was like, what is this? But then they said it has a great soundtrack. So I thought, okay, great. And then when it came on, the first time I saw it, I was like, yeah, this is it. So I watched it, and I even watched the second series. So as far as the Nightingale went, obviously I bought the soundtrack as soon as it came out on CD, and got to know that quite well. And the music was very different to what else I was listening to at the time, which was stuff like the Pixies and REM and sort of shoegaze and things like that. So having this kind of 50s music combined with the sort of soundtrack stuff was quite a nice change. And also, of course, the Julie Cruz thing. And the trouble is when you ask people to do a Twin Peaks tribute, everybody wants to do Falling or the Nightingale. They have real trouble trying to do the Bookhouse Boys or something, because like, what the what do you do
Who
with
did
that?
The Bookhouse Boys.
Somebody did do the Bookhouse Boys. I can't think of it offhand. I think we were the only people who did Falling, but I kind of said to Mike, I'm more strong armed, and I said, if I'm going to do this thing, I want that track. We had to put our hands up.
So Falling is the opening song, and then the endings, the outro song in the show Twin Peaks is, I think it's called Laura Palmer's theme song. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah. Yeah, so Falling is, to me, it's the most obvious one to actually be able to make a actual synth pop kind of version of a Angelo Badalamenti song because of the structure. So if you listen to the Diamond Field and Rat Rios version of the Nightingale, it follows the whole Julie Cruz version to a T. It's simply the arrangement that's been synthesized and kind of brought into this kind of synthwave, synthpop realm. And it actually, at that time, I had asked Rat Rios to do Closer. So that's how long Closer has taken to actually get out, because we actually started that before we did the Nightingale. And subsequently, the Nightingale's kind of taken on a life of its own, and it's ended up on a few other, like the Lynchland compilation, which is a French-based David Lynch tribute website, which is very well known, and also gets daily hits on YouTube saying, oh, I love this song, so... I think anything that you do like that within pop culture, the lifespan just keeps going because people, are so ingrained with that sort of thing that they just keep finding it. So it's a kind of a nice way of getting people to listen to your original music.
Do you follow the music on the new series? Like, there is some great music, like the song by the Chromatics.
Sure. And that's been real interesting. I listened to your Twin Peaks episode that you did last week, and you were talking about some of the differences in the new series, where specifically the different locations, how it's not just filmed in Twin Peaks, it's filmed in Las Vegas and New York and South Dakota or whatever, So it's the same with the music now. It's more broader. I don't know. I think I saw an article about how Angelo Badalamenti, what can you actually hear in the new Twin Peaks? Because there seems to be less of his music and more focus on the bands that close out the show. And it's almost like a, it's almost like Saturday Night Live or something, where the band is there, you know, they close out the show each time. So, you know, when you see that neon sign of the bar and the band starts playing.
Oh, the one with the gun, the Roadhouse.
Yeah, the Roadhouse bar, you think, oh, well, this must be the end of the show now because the band's on. And, you know, he had, what's her name, Van Etten on last week, and he's, I think, Lynch's own son's band was on it, and obviously the Chromatics, Johnny Jewel. And, but that's Lynch. He kind of pulls out these artists that might be completely unknown or obscure, or but they have a Lynch-esque feel. And I felt that, you know, coming back to the Black Lodge Girls song, Diamond Field with the Black Lodge Girls, Burning Blood, that was a real collaborative effort. I wrote the music and put it together, but I had a very Lynch-esque picture in my head about how that music should sound. And I had a sax player friend of mine who lives in Brooklyn, Chris, the saxophone warrior, who played the sax on it. So that was another Twin Peaks element, the sax. And then the two singers, Lucy Black and Jazzy Marscat, Jazzy did the talking and Lucy did the singing, and the words were written by Havana Chase. And she based those lyrics on a song from Fire Walk With Me soundtrack, which was, can't remember the name of it, another, what's it called, another something or other. And so what we did with that is I made a video to kind of illustrate how that might feel from a Lynch kind of perspective, quite a dark and slightly, you know, you're not sure what's going to happen in this. Are there shapes? Are there people? Are there spirits or whatever's going on? And then we made a lyric video out of it as well by doing the lyrics across in the Twin Peaks typeface. So the lyrics come across the screen as they're being spoken, because it is a spoken word type song. And having seen the new series and coming back and looking at Burning Blood, I feel like we kind of nailed that feeling that was post the TV show, but it kind of came out in Fire Walk With Me and also in the new series, where it's actually quite disturbing. And, you know, because you could watch the original version of Twin Peaks and there were some disturbing moments like Bob and things like that, but it wasn't till Fire Walk With Me and that, and the advent of cable TV, that Lynch can really pull out those really scary things.
Yeah, I think the original Twin Peaks was rated like PG.
Yeah, it wasn't very scary, but I think watching a few episodes by myself, I'd always kind of get the hairs on the back of my neck sort of sitting up and going, oh, you know, quite like to watch with someone else, actually, because it's a bit scary. Especially some of the later episodes of Series 2 and the Black Lodge and kind
yeah,
of stuff.
Yeah, I'm just finishing up the original series, so I'm like second to last episode. I'm getting very close to the end.
Uh-huh. It's a tough one. It's kind of, you got to hang in there, but I think it's definitely worthwhile for the continuity and, you know, just the whole, you have to watch the last episode at least. You know, but it's interestingly enough, we were talking about the graphics for the next peak. And so for each of those volumes, there were three volumes of albums. Two were tributes, Twin Peak tribute albums. So they had songs that were covers. And the third one was original songs inspired by Twin Peaks. So that's what we had with Burning Blood. So that was an original one. But all the covers depicted a seminal kind of identity from Twin Peaks. You know, there's the a kind of neon version of the original Twin Peaks cover on Volume 1, and then on Volume 2 there's a kind of neon version of Bob, and on the third version there's a neon version of the log from the Log Lady. And then there were some subsequent singles from that where the artists, like for Diane, the song Diane, there was a neon version of Cooper's little cassette recorder.
And there's even one called Audrey's Dance.
Yes, and it has a little shoe, a brogue shoe that, you know, Audrey Horne would wear on the cover of that one. So I started to get a little bit more obscure. You know, there's a Cherry Pie as well, of course. And the, you know, the like the opening of The Burning Blood is kind of an animated version of the Red Room with the curtains coming across.
Someone was joking somewhere that Twin Peaks invented Vaporwave because, like, the Red Room has checkered tile floor and the marble statue and the drapes.
Yes, yes. And I think I sent you that picture, Robert, of myself that I kind of superimposed to make it look like I was Cooper in the Red Room for the Twin Peaks, for the Next Peak sort of promo stuff. And so that was kind of fun to do that, and I put the statue in it, found a Venus de Milo or whatever it was, and threw it in there, and so yeah, it is like Macintosh Plus when you have that put a bust in there, you know, that kind of thing. And I guess around 1990, when personal computers were coming in a bit more, and that whole aesthetic, it kind of really has maybe an indirect tie-in with Vaporwave.
Do you have a favorite Twin Peaks character?
I was thinking about that, actually. I was obviously Cooper. I always liked Shelley because I thought she was cute. Incidentally, a friend of mine, a band called Midwave, released a song last year, or actually 2015, and it had her daughter, her real-life daughter, was the singer on it, and I did a Diamond Feel remix of that, so that was quite funny. So there was a Twin Peaks reference there, but I quite like it's kind of there are some Twin Peaks characters I actually didn't really like so much, you know, that I just thought were dumb.
I really like the who's that character, the fish in the percolator man. When I watched the series,
I forget his name.
Liked him for some reason. I thought he was a weird character.
There's always some weird characters. But as you know, I didn't really like Josie that much. She just kind of came across as kind of whiny and just like, you know, Sheriff Truman's kind of, I don't know, just, I know it was part of the plot. And, you know, one of the Horn brothers, he was, I'd have to kind of look at it again, but I think in series two...
Oh, Andrew Horn's our brother, who's a kind of eccentric guy.
Yeah. And he's in the latest one. He was in the first episode, but...
Oh, yeah, there's a scene with Andrew Horn as an old man.
Yeah. I think in the second series they kind of put a few... Like you were talking, you said soap opera. Kind of almost inserted some soap opera characters in there, and you can.
Well, originally, it was a parody making fun of a soap opera, but when I first heard about the show, I assumed it was just some cheesy soap opera. I kind of dismissed it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think definitely, I think the seminal characters always kind of, you know, come to mind when you think of Twin Peaks, and they're always likable, like, you know, Dale Cooper. And Audrey Horne, Donna. Yeah, I quite like Donna. You know, Leland Palmer and Mrs. Palmer, because she's actually a really great actress anyway. Grace Zabriskie. She's been in a whole lot of other things. And it's very interesting watching the new series about the zillions of actors that are in that show. It's like everybody is somebody, you know.
That, I don't know if you've seen that, but that actor who plays Leland Palmer, I think his name's Ray Wise. He was also in Tim and Eric's movie.
Yeah, he's been on so many things.
Tim and Eric movie was very bizarre. I'm not gonna.
Ray's kind of a strange guy, but actually, I've got a good Twin Peaks story in real life. When I was about 21, a friend of mine, we were flying to Las Vegas from Los Angeles, and we were on standby flights, so we couldn't go on the same plane together. So he went on one, and I went on one that was 30 minutes later. I was going to meet him at the airport. So I get off the plane, and I meet him in the baggage or whatever, and he says, you never guess who I sat next to on the plane. I'm going, oh, you know, so I went through a whole list of people. He said, nope. And he said, Agent Dale Cooper. And I'm like, I was just like, what? You got the straw? You know, you got to sit next to him. So it was. So he had a chat. Apparently, Kyle McLaughlin was going to Vegas to play golf or something. And it was nice enough to my friend was nice enough to get Kyle to write a little autograph to me, which I still have. It says, "See you in Twin Peaks," and it has a little cartoon of Twin Peaks mountains. Kyle McLaughlin, Agent Cooper, FBI. So that was my – I almost met Kyle McLaughlin story.
Oh, that was kind of your inspiration for the logo with the two peaks. Obviously, that's on the show, but
– yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, obviously, that's kind of a neonized version of it. But
yeah, if they ever decide to design a Twin Peaks themed casino in Vegas, they should hire you to do the exterior.
Now there's an idea, and we can have you know, the Dougie casino slot machine game. You know?
Yeah, the Dougie slot machino game. The exterior would be like the animated neon from your work. There could be a red room, and then there could be one part that would be like the Great Northern.
Yeah, and then you could have the murderous dwarf guy with the screwdriver running around. You have to escape from. And maybe you could go to the you know, the subdivision, which is Rancho, whatever, you know. It's the mind boggles, really, doesn't it? But it's kind of interesting with the Twin Peaks thing. Like I said before, it's kind of like when you're offered a thing to be involved in some pop culture that you're part of and that you like, and you can put together some kind of tribute to it and then use that as a way to bring other people into your own music. I think that's quite cool.
And with the soundtrack, you were touching on that with Falling from the Beginning. Obviously, that's the most kind of 80s synthwave sound. But what's remarkable about Badalamenti's work is he covers pretty much every genre. The film noir jazz sound, he mm-hmm. has country, 50s rock, kind of old western style music, pretty much everything.
Yeah, and some of us kind of synth nuts have been kind of dissecting some of that and saying, hey, you know, in that whole Twin Peaks score we can hear D50 patch, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like a Roland D50, which was a popular synthesizer at the time, is used quite a lot in his stuff. But for me, interestingly enough as well, like I actually play an Americana band. So I play in a band where we have a pedal steel player and we do kind of that kind of stuff. So whenever I'm playing that sort of music, I have that kind of, you know, David Lynch type, a kind of affection for it in a way, because it's almost like, you know, we play all these dive bars and they have neon signs advertising Bud Light or something and stuffed taxidermed animals in them, and you can spot characters at the bar straight out of Twin Peaks and you're
there's
playing
even,
music.
I forget the name of it, but there's a local bar near here in Santa Barbara that reminds me a lot of the Roadhouse.
I'm sure. They're all over the place, and that's the thing. It's kind of installing that small town kind of, you know, obviously Santa Barbara maybe is not so much a small town in the way that some others are because it's a bit more affluent, but, you know, there's always those kind of reality places that are interwoven into these things, and they do exist, and they are interesting places that you can get good stories from and good characters from. Even by driving past and looking at the sign from the outside, you'd go, hey, that bar is where I'd find the guy who's sitting there telling his life story, and or, you know, is he going to go and rob a bank, or, you know, is he running drugs from Canada or whatever, you know?
With the merchandise that was put out for the Twin Peaks series, there's a T-shirts. Is mm-hmm. that still available?
I think so. There were a couple of different designers involved that submitted designs, and obviously we used some of the ones from the record covers. There was one of the Neon Bob, stuff like that, and Mike did a few as well. And I think they're sort of the T-shirts that you order, and they're kind of printed on-demand type print. So I would assume that you could probably still get them. I'm not quite sure. I said to Mike recently, hey, you know, Twin Peaks is is on again, we should be pushing the compilations again. So I would hope so.
Do you think that the new Twin Peaks series will use either your work or some new retrowave band for the final scene at the Roadhouse?
That'd be great. I think someone suggested that just yesterday, actually. They said, so are you going to end up in the last scene in the Roadhouse? Because, you know, is Rat Reels going to be singing? And she's a huge Twin Peaks nut. She actually did a show in Dallas a couple of weeks ago where they did a Twin Peaks tribute show. The answer would be no, because we would have done it by now if we had been asked. And even if we were, we probably wouldn't be able to say due to Lynch's NDAs. But
and Lynch seems like the kind of person, like, he's not going to choose the person who asks.
No, and, you know, that's the power of the internet is that those things can actually happen. And if you hashtag the crap out of something or whatever, or somebody finds something and puts it in front of them, or they find it themselves, you know, Lynch is probably the sort of guy who makes music, so he could go out there and listen to stuff and look at things. You know, it wouldn't be some marketing guy putting it in front of him and saying, how about this? Maybe one day something like that will happen, or for another film or whatever. That would be awesome. And I would like to think that, you know, Lynch or whoever would come across our version of the Nightingale or the Burning Blood song and go, hey, I really like this. This is great. You know, thanks, guys. This is a good tribute. And, you know, he got his money from the Harry Fox agency which is the thing where you have to apply to get a license to cover a song. So he got his, you know, $30 from me or whatever it was. so hopefully one day, who knows? And if it's not him, then it might be someone else who goes, hey, you know, we like what you guys did for that. You want to do something for us. So
there is a film director in France who is making a new retrowave horror film. I discovered him via the interview with Absolute Valentine, but I forget the name of the film.
There's actually a few. Because there's the English one, The Summoner.
Oh, that's the one.
Yeah. And that stars Adam McNabb, who's the voice of Lee Cassette, you probably heard of. They're sort of a synthwave act out of London. Adam is actually an actor, but he's got that great kind of deep synth pop sort of voice. And they're a very popular act, actually, in the scene. So he plays a guy who it's almost like Ghostbusters. You know, you call him up and he exercises the spirits from your house type thing. And you can find a trailer for that online at the moment. There's quite a long trailer for it. I saw some other stuff as well. It seems to be the thing to do now, and it's you've seen that documentary they're making, The Rise of the Synths, which is a Kickstarter film about the whole synthwave scene and the artists that have kind of spearheaded it and how they came together, you know, College and Electric Youth and all that kind of stuff, through to the Carpenter Brut and some of the newer acts. And I think they raised, I don't know, $100,000 on Kickstarter to get that going. But they're from Europe.
Because I remember a while back, I kind of got the impression that the genre peaked right around the time that the film Drive came out, and they featured College, Electric Youth, and I think Kavinsky as well. But a lot of people are saying it's actually still growing.
Yeah, I think actually Drive was kind of the catalyst for a lot of the acts. And as I first mentioned to you at the start, you know, I've been making this sort of music for a long time, and it just happened that there wasn't an audience, and then suddenly I think Drive came out and something kind of clicked for people, and they said, oh, because there's so much synth pop around, and there was the Electroclash thing in the early 2000s and stuff, and it's all been elements of 80s music, but there was this kind of thing that was missing from it that didn't make it synthwave, if you know what I mean, because you can still find synth pop acts out there, but they're not synthwave, if you know what I mean, because they're kind of lacking this. I don't know if it's the nostalgia thing or the ethos of the kind of 80s thing that makes synth pop synthwave, if you know what I mean.
One of the songs you did with Rat Rios kind of reminds me of a College and Electric Youth song, A Real Human Being, but I can't think of the name of your song off the top of my head.
But that's probably closer.
Yeah, that must be the one. You're from your latest album.
Yeah, that's it's interesting because, you know, when you release a song, you send the track out to blogs and you spend about a week in front of the computer sending these emails to people saying, please listen to this, and writing press releases and stuff. And quite a few of them came back rejected, didn't like the song because it sounded like something from Drive or it sounded too 80s. And which I took as a compliment because it's like, duh, yeah, that's kind of actually what it's meant to sound like. So the fact that people were saying this sounds like something from Drive, I did take as a compliment, although I wasn't consciously trying to emulate those songs. I guess it just comes through. I mean, a synthesizer is a synthesizer and a drum machine is a drum machine. There's kind of a limited number of ways you can make those things sound. Unless you circuit bent them or do crazy stuff with them, you know? So, yeah. And if people like Drive, maybe they'll like Diamond Field, you know? But interestingly, say, about the album is still underway. It's about 80% done. We have 12 tracks, and they all have a different vocalist, so that's why it takes a little bit longer. There's people from New Zealand, there's people from the US, there's someone from Australia. And there's sort of a mix of 50-50 male-female vocals.
So you prefer to upload it gradually than just to put your album out all at once?
No, this album will come out all at once. Closer will be on it. It's kind of like the lead single to try and create a little bit of interest in the album to just kind of set the tone. And because of the nature of Diamond Field, if you listen to Neon Summer and then you listen to the next single, The City, which had a male vocalist and was more kind of synth pop, and then Closer, which is female sort of synth pop, the album kind of expands on that, and it has more of the Neon Summer type thing, and it has kind of sort of some West Coast yacht rock sounding stuff. It's got synth pop, it's got kind of prog fusion stuff on it with an 80s bent to it. So the album, like the singles are one thing, but the album's kind of like the open book. It's like, well, this is a whole lot of stories and different singers and different kind of sounds coming together as one thing. Sounds a bit kind of airy fairy, but hopefully it'll be one of those records that people kind of get into.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Andy Diamond from Diamond Field for being on. It's been an excellent show. A big fan of your work.
Thanks, Robert, and thanks, Pill Eater, as well. For awesome. Yeah, it'd be great to extend and speak for another 3 hours. I'm sure we'd have plenty to talk about. But I always I enjoy listening to your show, Robert, and all the different things that you cover. It's not just music, and I think that's for me as an artist, it's really important to talk about music, but also other things. So it's great to have someone who can open up other lines of conversation.